Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulip. This week we'll hear about SPF 9, the 9th annual Summer Performance Festival, from three of the participants, dancer and executive director of Safe House, Joe Landini, and choreographers Joanne Selisker and Sarah Bush. Playwright Robin Bradford is joined by human rights organizer Kelly Cutler to talk about the Three Girls Theater production of Low Hanging Fruit. It's a production being staged at Z Below. Plus, we'll hear about the now classic La Cage aux Folles, which rounds out the new Bay Area musicals season. We'll hear from actor Clay David and founder of the company, Matthew McCoy. Stay with us. Three Girls Theater Company, or 3GT, presents the San Francisco premiere of Bay Area-based playwright Robin Bradford's Low Hanging Fruit, which tells the compelling story of four homeless women struggling to survive on Los Angeles's Skid Row. It was written as a response to the dramatic rise in homelessness among women who have served in the military in Iraq and Afghanistan, and focuses on the aftermath of war as seen through their lives. 3GT resident playwright Robin Bradford joins me in studio. She's an award-winning writer, director, and producer who transitioned from some 25 years as CEO of a highly successful Bay Area staffing company to independent film production and playwriting. This, her most recent play, Low Hanging Fruit, had a critically acclaimed world premiere run at the Zephyr Theater in L.A. in 2014, then went on to receive productions in Michigan and South Carolina, now receiving its San Francisco debut. In addition to Robin's work as a playwright, her screenplays have been celebrated at festivals and competitions nationwide, and her screenplay La Bella Diva was a finalist for the Sundance Screenwriters Lab. Robin, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much.
Very happy to have you here. She's joined by Kelly Cutler from the Coalition on Homelessness to shed some light on this surprisingly growing problem. Kelly is a San Francisco State and City College grad who has been working with the Coalition since 2013. Kelly, welcome to Open Air as well.
Thank you.
Well, Robin, what was the initial inspiration for shedding light on this remarkably difficult subject?
Well, as you mentioned, it stemmed from an article I read in the newspaper a few years ago. It was actually in the Huffington Post, and they quoted a statistic of women veterans at that time being the largest growing segment of the homeless population. And it just seemed like such an outrageous thing to me that, 'cause I think we all understand that there are many homeless who are veterans, but you think of them as guys in the puffy black jackets. You know, you don't think of them as younger women who are obviously very qualified as part, very important part of society, that they would slip through the cracks in the numbers that they have. And so I started investigating it. I went to Los Angeles and interviewed quite a few people on Skid Row and thought that writing a play about it, writing a screenplay about it, could be a very good way to draw attention to it and hopefully raise some awareness of people in our area and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, did you work with Robin in a certain way or help her shape some of the caricatures or characterizations, I should say, of the women involved?
No, we're just meeting now, actually.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, great.
I wish I had known her.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Well, tell us about your work with the Coalition.
I am a human rights organizer with the Coalition on Homelessness, and what we do is we bring together service providers, community members, but especially people that are experiencing homelessness, because they're really the experts. And we aren't a social service provider, but we work on the policy side. And we also have a Housing Justice, as well as the Street Sheet publication that you'll see people selling.
Was the recent focus of all the media outlets on homelessness helpful for the work you're doing?
In ways, it was helpful. We were a bit nervous about what was going to be coming out, but I was very surprised that there was a lot of really good reporting that was out there to really raise awareness, because people are surprisingly not aware of the reality of homelessness and the actual issues. And a big misconception is that homelessness is a choice, and it really isn't. So I think that shed some light onto it.
Mm-hmm. And Robin, I'm sure you came to realize that as well.
Absolutely.
These characters are not actual people, but they're amalgams of people that you've heard about.
Well, they were amalgams of people I met, and then a big part of the play, I'd say the majority of it, is strictly from my overactive imagination. I didn't want to take any of the stories that people told me directly and kind of, you know, make something of it, but it was more the tone and just the background that some of these people have. I like Kelly says, I mean, I was surprised to find out that there's such a difference in the types of people. And it's not, you cannot categorize homeless people as being in one group, because they come from all over the place, from all kinds of backgrounds. And that's one of the things that I think is very challenging in providing services to homeless people, is that you really have to, and we have to, as citizens, look at them as individuals.
It's shocking to think that, you know, here these military veterans, they're on the street and not being taken care of.
Right. And, you know, there are some really good programs out there, and the work that Kelly's organization does is fantastic, and there are other groups that have really attempted to attack this problem. But then we also have, at least for the veterans, on the services side, you have these enormous, you know, giant monolithic bureaucratic organizations. And if somebody hasn't had a good experience in the military, and then they have to face sort of climbing through the bureaucracy of the VA, there are a lot of them that just give up before they start, and they don't get the benefits that they could actually qualify for.
Okay, so let's delve into your overactive imagination here, and you can tell us about the three characters that you created, and then how a fourth one enters in.
Well, actually, there are four characters who live on, they're all veterans of Iraq or Afghanistan, and they've clustered together on the street in Los Angeles, and they have a tent encampment that they've nicknamed the Taj Mahal, and they're there because they trust each other, and they have these shared experiences in the military, and they have a cardinal rule that nobody is allowed in camp unless they're ex-military. And then one of these women befriends a young runaway.
Oh, so it's four, then adding a fifth, not three adding a four, my bad.
No. And so they bring her, she introduces her to her campmates, and they want nothing to do with it because they're, first of all, afraid that they'll get unwanted attention from the authorities by having a young, you know, an underage person there, but also because she violates that rule of nobody but ex-military. And so when she comes in, things change for all of them. And they all have demons that they're struggling to overcome, substance abuse. One of them is a prostitute. One of them is trying to get home, trying to bring herself off the street, but she has a drinking problem, and she doesn't believe her family wants anything to do with her until she gets herself straight. And, yeah, so there's a lot of colorful language, and I think that's, for me, what has been a very gratifying experience to write this story, using language that I don't normally use in my everyday existence.
That's playwright Robin Bradford, author of Low Hanging Fruit at Z Space through the 30th of this month at Z Below. This production is being directed by Lewis Parnell. Tell me the work with him that you've done, and was he also involved in the other productions?
I have a new play called Slice that he directed recently, and he's just a very, but those are the two times that we've worked together. He's an incredibly talented director, and I think partially because he's such an experienced actor. So he really has a feel for what actors go through in trying to bring characters to life and do so in an authentic way.
Mm-hmm.
And since this is the fourth production of the play, it's been really fun to watch how these various directors work, and all of them have different techniques. And Louis is just a stellar director.
So there's no rollover from the cast from other productions. This is a completely
just one. Okay. One. The person who originated the role of Alice in Los Angeles has come up for this production, and she's just amazing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the other actors we have are tremendous as well.
Kelly, wondering, what have you seen? Has the acting community in San Francisco here responded well to activism that you've been doing with the coalition?
That's an interesting question. There's actually lately with different funding that is there's a tax that's on the ballot that is shared with the art community. And so that's a way, and actually art plays a lot in the work that we do, from different visuals has been a big part of the history of the organizing and activism,
because
mm-hmm. it catches your eye, you know, when you see really great art, it's like, oh, getcha.
Yeah, it's Kelly Cutler with the Coalition on Homelessness.
And it's such a great outlet for people who, you know, or may not have that luxury of being able to create something, and to have to provide that ability for them to sit down and draw or paint or do whatever is really fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Kelly's going to be involved with one of the community nights special presentations. Your presentation will be on Thursday, July 28th. During the entire month-long run of Low Hanging Fruit, four different nonprofit organizations that offer support to San Francisco veterans and homeless people starts tonight with a group from North Beach Citizens. And then next week, Compass Family Services on the 21st, San Francisco Suicide Prevention, which is also a tremendous problem with veterans especially. And then I mentioned the 28th Coalition on Homelessness. We do have some tickets to offer, folks, don't we, for which performances?
For this evening.
For this evening's performance. Mm-hmm. This is at Z-Below, 470 Florida Street here in San Francisco. Low Hanging Fruit by Robin Bradford, directed by Louis Parnell. 415-841-4134. Operators are standing by. 415-841-4134 if you'd like to see Low Hanging Fruit by Robin Bradford at Z-Below on Florida Street. Robin, what's coming up for you after this? Is activism now firmly rooted in your psyche for creative purposes?
Yes. I mean, through writing this play, I really have kind of found my voice in terms of what my interests are and what I think I can write well. And it's less about dance, although I love going to Broadway shows and hearing lovely music and watching fantastic actors. I think my own interest is more in figuring out the human psyche and what happens to people and why they get into situations that they can't get out of, and, you know, sort of working it that way. So my next piece is another drama called Slice, and it's about a 14-year-old girl who lives in the Tenderloin with her addict mother. And the mother has an infant that, because of her going off on benders and so forth, the girl is put into the position of taking care of. And so her way of managing her own stress is to, she has a blog and she also cuts. And so it's this relationship between the mother and the daughter. And I just find it really interesting.
Neat. Well,
another uplifting subject from a local playwright.
Well, you know, it's got to be done, and it's a really effective way to inform people.
It is. It's a way that people can approach a difficult topic and get into it in some depth and yet not really have to step out of their comfort zone. And it just, there's something about live theater that's so compelling and so different than reading. And I'm a huge reader, but different than reading and different than going to a film or watching television. It's just, you're in it, and you just have to go on the ride. So
415-841-4134 if you'd like tickets to tonight's performance at 8 p.m. at the Z Below space here in San Francisco. And tonight's 6:45 pre-performance community night will involve North Beach Citizens. A little bit about North Beach Citizens. They're a community-based nonprofit that utilizes the strength of the neighborhood to effectively address the needs of homeless and low-income citizens through a collaboration of residents, merchants, police, and service providers. Information about them at northbeachcitizens.org. Kelly Cutler, what can one do with the Coalition on Homelessness? I mean, people say, you know, everyone needs money. Mm-hmm. Give us money. But how can one become further involved in actually helping?
Actually, they can become part of our work group. We've got two work groups every Wednesday at 12:30. We have a human rights work group. And on Tuesdays at noon, we have the housing justice work group. But often people aren't available because they're working during those times. So we put out onto social media, especially Facebook, about different actions we're having. And so coming out and supporting that way. Funding is definitely a big one because we do not get money from the city or the state. But also another thing is like art. It's really tapping into people's strengths. And that's something that from writing to art to, you know, storytelling is a big part of our work. And so, and also just learning from the work that we're doing and share it with your friends, like what you're talking about here with where that everyone has a different story. And so, like what this play is doing is helping with the work that we're doing, breaking some of the social stigma, which is a major issue.
Kelly Cutler, thanks for coming in. More information about the Coalition on the Homelessness at their website, cohsf.org. Low-Hanging Fruit by Robin Bradford. Robin, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
The compelling story of four homeless women veterans of Iraq, Afghanistan, struggling to survive on L.A.'s Skid Row, is at Z Below, 470 Florida Street, through the end of this month. Information at three Girls Theater, theaterre.org, threegirlstheater.org. Thanks again for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Safe House Arts, which is working to incubate new performing artists through residencies, workshops, and performance opportunities, presents its ninth annual Summer Performance Festival, SPF9, featuring 10 programs over 5 days through this Sunday. I caught up with several of the creative forces behind this year's festival, including dancer-choreographer Joe Landini, who is founding director and executive director of Safe House. He's been on the Bay Area performing arts scene for 25 years, and his choreography has been presented around California, as well as in London, Mexico City, and Santa Fe, New Mexico. He's also a recent recipient of the San Francisco Bay Guardians Goldie Award. Sarah Bush's namesake Sarah Bush Dance Project presents dance in a variety of forms, from ballet to modern, hip-hop, jazz, Afro-Caribbean, and contact improvisation. Acclaimed performances since 1997 or so have been a highlight of almost every season here in the Bay Area. She's sharing a double bill this weekend with Joanne Selisker, who is presenting a one-woman show with a very personal perspective, presenting, as she calls it, scenes, quote, from one woman's awkward, ridiculous, and beautiful struggle to love, lose love, and keep on living. I caught up with all three earlier this week at ODC's beautiful performance space on 17th Street here in San Francisco. Joe Landini, Sarah Bush, welcome back to Open Air.
Happy to be here.
Hi, David. Great to be back.
And Joanne Selisker, welcome to Open Air. We'll talk with you in a moment.
Thank you very much.
Joe, this is the ninth annual Summer Performance Festival, biggest to date, a real testimony to the remarkable thirst for dance here in the Bay Area, unrivaled, I think, by any other metropolitan area, I would think.
Well, we're probably neck and neck with New York, but yeah, I would agree with you on that.
This is taking place under the umbrella organization that's presenting SPF9, Safe House Arts, SAFE standing for Save Arts from Extinction.
Yeah, that's our tagline. We were really excited about being able to use that that name when we came up with it. And the festival's been great. We've been really enjoying being at ODC.
So what's contributed to this being the largest and so far?
You know, I think that the community has grown, and you know, every year we have more and more young choreographers moving to the Bay Area despite the cost of living, and it's becoming more and more difficult for a lot of the choreographers to get produced. And so one of the great things about this particular festival is it's completely free for them to participate.
Well, part of the saving arts from extinction aspect has to be the difficult cost of living for performers here in the Bay Area.
Yeah, exactly. And we love being at ODC, but ODC is a gorgeous theater. And of course, it's a little on the expensive side. So we're really excited to be able to produce, I think it's 18 groups this year.
But the facilities of ODC are just amazing, not just the wonderful new theater on 17th Street, but next door.
Yeah, absolutely. They have the new studios that they opened a couple of years ago. And I think the most exciting part is participating in this long tradition. You know, the theater's been here for about 30 years. And so to have the opportunity to be part of that legacy is pretty exciting.
This weekend also marks the return to the stage for you as a dancer, Joe, after a decade or so hiatus. Tell us about your work in progress, Soma, Now and Then.
You know, it was an interesting process. A collaborator of mine, Amy Lewis, had wanted to work together, and her work is sort of based on doing research on different neighborhoods and focused on regentrification and the loss of spaces in the Bay Area. And so she had worked in the Tenderloin previously, and so she wanted to do a piece about Soma, about the working class families that have been displaced, and then in later years, the queer communities that were displaced. So over a bottle of wine, we had like this very long research session. I'm going to say research with quotation marks on it. I might have had a little bit too much red wine. And out of that...
You know, no such thing.
Yeah, exactly. and out of that, well, wait till my family hears this text. But out of that, a really interesting piece emerged out of that.
But this is a very personal story for you.
Yeah, very personal. The red wine was a great way to make it pretty personal because I wasn't really thinking that it was going to become a performance piece, and so I was pretty candid with some of the language. But looking back in retrospect, I'm pretty happy about that because I think it's a very unvarnished look at some of my experiences in the South of Market in the 80s and the 90s, and I think it was an experience that a lot of queer men had in the 80s and 90s.
And so this is solo work. What will we actually see then? And what is Amy bringing to the table? I mean, you're both choreographers. What is she bringing as a director that's different?
Well, what's been great about Amy is she did the interview, and then she directed the piece. And so what's been really lovely about that is it's given me the opportunity to be the performer. And so I generated the text, and then I improv the movement. But what's great about working with Amy was she took all the material and directed it, which took a lot of the responsibility off of my shoulders so that I didn't have to worry about sequences and directing and things like that. So she was an outside eye, basically created the house that the material can exist in.
Off mic, you were talking a little bit about being different, coming up to the dance world again as a 50-odd someone.
Right, right, yeah. It's funny, I was just telling the other choreographers, my muscle memory is being a young dancer, right? And I was always a very big dancer, very athletic. And now my 53-year-old body hasn't quite caught up with that that old memory. So I'm a little sore today. I've been running the piece all week, and I keep thinking, gosh, I wish I had choreographed an easier piece.
Well, it's speaking of, you know, a bigger dancer that you are, you're in fine shape, but it's also nice to see inclusion as an important element of this festival, and Lucia August's Everybody Can Dance this weekend. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, Lucia describes her body as being a non-standard dancer body, and I think that's a great way of putting it. She's an older woman, and she had several other careers before she was a dancer. And then her later years, I think in her 40s and 50s, she really made a commitment to being a full-time dancer. And now it's beautiful to watch her emerge, and she has this beautiful body, and she's a beautiful mover and a beautiful storyteller. So it's just such a joy to watch her just sort of blossom on stage.
Sarah Bush, your presentations on Saturday and Sunday are inspired by three trailblazing women who spent time in Oakland, two of which I'm familiar with, Gertrude Stein and Isadora Duncan. But tell me and our audience a little bit about Ina Coolbrith.
Sure. Ina Coolbrith was California's first poet laureate. So the first poet laureate was a woman, and it was Ina. And so she was also in Oakland, and I love that those three women, their lives intersected in that city for a brief
period of time. And Ina was writing her poetry. She received her award and then took on a role as a caregiver for several family members and also took on the role of the librarian for Oakland's public library at the time, which meant she became a teacher and caregiver to the up-and-coming children that were Isadora Duncan and Gertrude Stein. So here's this woman who is in herself, in her own right, an artist, and she puts her own poetry aside to care for others, and for many years. And then she comes back to it finally later in life. I guess the kids all grow up, and in her 80s, she has arthritis in her hands, and she can't write in the climate of the Bay Area. So she actually goes to New York City in the roaring 20s as an 80-year-old. She goes there, I think it's the winters that are actually better for her arthritis. So she goes to New York winters for 3 years, spends 6 months or something, you know, goes there seasonally for 3 years in her 80s to complete one last book of poetry. And just...
I'm sorry, back up a minute.
Yeah.
Before, she was looking at New York as a place to be in the winter for her arthritis? Where was she before? The Arctic?
Yeah, right. This is what I've read. I am definitely not a historical expert, but the more I dive into reading about these three women, the more I just am in love with their lives and their stories, as well as their written word that they leave behind for us as this testament to their life and their work as artists.
And for the less enlightened, perhaps give us a little bit about Gertrude Stein and Isadora Duncan and their Oakland connection.
Sure. They were both in Oakland in their youth, and Gertrude Stein is known as a poet and author, and what I have loved about Gertrude's work in particular for my artistic purposes, there are recordings of her reciting her poetry, and it is almost mechanical sounding. So it's like having a metronome in rehearsal, this like staccato reading of text, and in some ways, it's nonlinear, and she has interesting patterns of repetition and accumulation with her words, which can be a choreographic structure that a lot of choreographers look to as well. So that's been a nice influence there. And Isadora Duncan, a lot of us in the dance community know as the mother of modern dance, but she also is this incredible writer. And to find her words and how much her words speak to... so much of what I believe about being a woman dancer, about the range of possibility, the strength, the spirituality, the humanity of the woman dancer, versus any sort of simplistic sexuality of a woman dancer, the limited sort of boxes we could be put into. I've really enjoyed her empowering sense of the woman dancer in her writing. And this piece is part of a series that I've been working on this last season called This Land. So it's looking at women writers connected to places in landscape. So this particular piece, thanks to the generous RAW residency at Safe House, the resident artist workshop at Safe House, we had rehearsal space there in at One Grove, but we also would alternate our rehearsals with an outdoor site-specific place. So we worked with the Cascade Staircase at Joaquin Miller Park in Oakland, Oakland being where these three lives intersected, and also Joaquin Miller had a relationship, a camaraderie with Ina Coolbrith as well. So I loved all these tie-ins. So using the physical environment and the words and the history to influence the movement that got generated, and to keep alternating whether we're creating in the outdoor terrain or whether we're in the sort of more smooth, easy terrain of the studio or the theater, that both those environments gave a unique context and texture to the work.
So just knowing very little about Ina Coolbrith and about Gertrude Stein, mm-hmm. and Isadora Duncan, just from what you said, it sounds like we're going to be able to instantly tell who is dancing which role.
Yes, I do think that will be clear. One way it's easy to tell is that each dancer will enter as a soloist, and there's poetry being recited from that artist. So Ina Coolbrith enters first because she was born first, and you'll hear her poetry, then Gertrude Stein, and then Isadora Duncan. And also we really tried to find physical characteristics, mostly with hands, that we thought were unique symbols for each of the women. So the arthritis, the waving scarf, the of Isadora Duncan's, you know, sort of infamous death, and Gertrude Stein with this almost addictive writing of a pencil in her hand. Yes, I think you'll be able to tell who's who.
And are you portraying them at this particular time in their lives in Oakland when they happen to be intersecting, or is it different stages of their life?
I'd say it's more abstract than that. I think it's a general look at what we imagine their lives may have been like and the physical embodiment of what their challenges may have been as women at that time doing their art, supporting others and struggling to sort of achieve and reach, the title of the piece is reach, to reach whatever feels like success for them as artists. What would that physical struggle possibly have felt like for them at that time? And of course, these are three, the dancers that play the three roles, Nina Wu, Chelsea Hill, and Nicole Casado, they each bring their own unique experience, of course, to the role. And they, as three individuals, didn't know each other before working on this piece. So I like that they are three artists, women, whose lives have magically intersected and overlapped in Oakland as well. So they certainly bring their own life story and into their bodies and into their performance of the work.
That's Sarah Bush. Her work, Reach, is presented this Saturday and Sunday as part of Safe House Arts SPF 9, 10 programs over 5 days. Also talking with Joe Landini, the founder of Safe House Arts, now in its 9th season. And Sarah, you're sharing the double bill this weekend with Joanne Selisker. Joanne, tell us about your solo show. What's best for you?
My piece is about the loss of relationship. My partner of 25 years died, and I watched her die, and the piece is kind of about a collection of the voices that we hear when caring for a loved one. It's about the difficulty of watching someone die and at the same time needing to support in a way, and also facing a future without a partner. But it's mostly, it's a collection of some of the outrageous things we say to people who are dealing with death, like take care of yourself. If you're taking care of a loved one, you cannot take care of yourself. And it's a collection of those kinds of statements that are meant well, they're well-meaning, but the impact is, that's what this is about, is the impact of those kinds of statements. When people are trying to be helpful, it's a collection of all those things they say and how it affected me in particular physically. So I have simple gestures that express that tension, the struggle to keep hope alive for this person when I myself was facing I was hopeless. So it's about that struggle of being so desperate but trying to be hopeful, and the world around you trying to say, oh, she'll live through this, she will be fine. And also, Jane, she got sick at the time that you could not get married legally in California, but you could get married in Iowa. And so we had to fly to Iowa to get married so that I could get her benefits. But you have to be married 6 months before you can get benefits. And she died 5 months and 9 days after we got married. So that's the political scene. And we forget that that's the world we used to live in, that it wasn't an option. And many of us are still experiencing that discrimination in our lives, and yeah.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss. It must be very painful, but cathartic in terms of the grieving process of bringing your partner back to life in a way.
Yeah, it does feel like a tribute to her. I feel very proud of the relationship we had. I did a piece at ODC about my relationship with her when I was in residence here. So it's really lovely to bring it back here, to bring back another reflection on my life with Jane. And at that point, the world was very different, and I was dealing with coming out, and that was a whole different thing in a very, it was 20-some years ago. No, it wasn't. It was 10, 15 years ago. Even not that long ago, it was so different, and coming out was the issue, and I did a piece about that here. And now we forget that we assume that all rights are equal, but marriage, you do not have the same rights when you're dealing with important things like death and survival.
So extremely personal work coming from Joanne Seliskier as a part of the double bill with Sarah Bush. Joanne, what will we hear during that solo performance?
You will hear some of the things that I said that I regretted saying, and you'll get a sense of what that's like to be saying things that you wish you hadn't at such a critical time, and primarily a lot of the things that people say to you, like take care of yourself, and you know, you just need to keep her spirits up and she'll be fine.
Well-meaning platitudes, but sometimes that cannot be helpful.
Yeah, and I think there's humor in that. So that is what the frame is for the whole piece. And then there are moments of the pain, but I think the beauty is in that, what can you do with a pain like that but make beauty of it? So I feel like I did my best sort of physically to do something beautiful with it, and include the pain in it, not just pretty, but to you feel the pain, but you also get to see the ridiculous struggle and the humor of that. We all try to take care of each other, and we do it in weird ways, and it hurts people, and it sometimes it helps, and sometimes it hurts, but it's common experience.
Joanne Seliskier's What's Best for You, sharing a double bill with Sarah Bush's works this weekend as part of the SPF9, the Summer Performance Festival, number 9, from Safe House Arts. Information at safehousearts.info. Joe Landini, back to you regarding what we're hearing. We're hearing words as well as music. As a musician, I'm curious, is anything being presented with live music?
You know, we don't do a lot of live music because it's such a big festival. It's really hard to, you know, find the resources to support the live musicians. I know that Kayla Branigan and Amelia Eisen are working with a live musician, but primarily most of the choreographers are working with recorded music.
Always safer, too. The same movements can be done over and over again.
This is Sarah. I have sort of a fun hybrid of that. I worked with live musicians in a earlier stage performance of the piece. So we were at the Cascade Steps, and I had the Anita Lofton Project on vocals, guitar, and live violin as part of the sound score along with the poetry. And I recorded that performance. And so the audio recording of that performance is the audio recording that now goes into the theater with this piece. So it's not quite like having live music in the room, but it does have that feel to it still, as well as the environmental sound. So you'll hear the audience, there's a baby crying. And that day when we were outside, it even started to rain midway through the piece. And I even, when I listen, can hear the rain on the recording too. So I like this sort of hybrid of, there's not live musicians in the room, but it was definitely, I'm so grateful for working with Anita and the Anita Lofton Project to bring this sound to it that felt both contemporary and of another time, which this piece feels like it rides both those worlds, and so their music was perfect.
Sarah Bush, thanks for taking a little time today. And for the remaining 10 programs over these 5 days through July 10th, visit safehousearts.info. Joe Landini, thanks for taking some time as well.
Thanks so much. It's been a joy.
Sarah.
Thank you, David.
And Joanne, let's have you on again soon.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Is it that in all the universe there is but one great cry containing sorrow, joy, ecstasy, agony, the mother cry of creation, Isadora Duncan.
Sarah Bush's En Plein Air, production of Reach, replete with bird chirps and the rain softly falling. That's the Anita Lofton project, Zalissa Clark on violin with Anita on guitar, later on vocals. Starting off with Sarah's mother reading a portion of the poetry of Isadora Duncan, Reverend Barbara Hamilton Hallway. Information about Safe House Arts, its 9th annual Summer Performance Festival, SPF9, at safehousearts.info. Bay Area Musicals, exclamation mark, the newest nonprofit theatrical organization to join the vibrant San Francisco Bay Area arts community, closes out its inaugural season with the multiple Tony Award-winning musical comedy La Cage aux Folles, with performances through July 31st at San Francisco's Victoria Theater here on 16th Street. Matthew McCoy, Bay Area Musicals founder and artistic director, joins me in studio to reflect on the year, share some details about this production, and perhaps tell us what's in store for season two. Matthew, welcome back to Open Air.
David. Nice to be back. Thank you.
He's joined by Clay David in the role of Georges. Clay's a, let's call him a quadruple threat with broad experience acting, directing, artistic design, and production management. Among his achievements in the theater are the Theater Bay Area Titan Award for Excellence in Theater, the Dean Goodman Best Director in San Francisco Bay, Lee Hartgrave's FAME Best Play Award, and the Victor Borga Award. He's also Artistic Director of the award-winning Alta Arena Playhouse in Alameda, and will be directing Our Town there this fall. Clay, welcome to you.
Good morning to you. Hi.
Hi. Matt, a full season of Bay Area Musicals exclamation mark coming to a close.
Yeah.
Give us a little reflection on your year as the first season.
Sure. This is the last show of our inaugural season. With every show, we've learned so much, if not even more, than I had ever anticipated. This show,
the good, the bad, and the ugly might be.
Oh, it's all there. It is all there. Our first show we did was How to Succeed, which it was big sets, big costumes, big lights. Then we took a tone down a little bit with Hair, doing a minimalistic version at the Victoria. And now we've kind of found this happy medium with a darker version of La Cage aux Folles, but still have the sparkles and the glitter and the feather boas. They're all still there.
Okay, well, talk about this different interpretation, because I think people will most likely have in mind the Mike Nichols-directed film.
Sure. I mean, The Cage aux Folles is an iconic musical. I mean, when it came out in 1987 on Broadway, it won, like you mentioned, 9 Tony Awards in total. That includes the Broadway show and then the revivals that came years following to be this big, over-the-top drag world. When I was doing some research, the show set in 1977. I was doing research of the location, Saint-Tropez. In that time period, the gay clubs and culture were all underground. It was all very hidden. Mostly cigarette smoke drifting through the candles with poppers in the corner. So we've kind of gone that route.
That's not jalapeno poppers.
No, not jalapeno poppers. So we're taking more of this dark, gritty route with our production that has more of this underground sexual feel to it by still keeping it. The message is there, which is about love and acceptance.
Not quite the grit that's a little further downtown at Cabaret. But they're a little grittier.
Yeah. No, we're not that dark. We're not that dark. We still have love and happiness, and we still end on a positive note. I mean, this was the first musical on Broadway to have two men kissing as the finale number, and we've kept that true, especially with times right now, what's happening with good and the bad. You know, the good, it'll be 1 year now that the Supreme Court has ruled to move forward with LGBTQ marriages, same-sex marriages across the country. And then with recent attacks of the Orlando attack, I mean, I don't think we could have picked a better show to be happening right now that centers around the love and the marriage of two gay men.
Well, let's talk about the plot a little bit for those that aren't familiar with La Cage.
Sure. So it centers around Alban and George, who own a drag nightclub in France in Saint-Tropez, and their son, Jean-Michel, who George had with a woman back in the early years of his career. And George and Alban end up raising Jean-Michel. So when Jean-Michel comes back to visit, he introduces the information that he's getting married. And he happens to get married to a girl of a politician who is anti-homosexual, a fanatic, a radical about it, who actually plans, if he gets in office, to close all of the drag nightclubs, including one just like La Cage aux Folles. So the story kind of weaves its way around there of how they end up getting the family and working around the family that's coming to visit. Part of the struggles is Jean-Michel not wanting to have Alban there because he doesn't like the way that he acts and talks and dresses up as a woman. And so you have to come to the show and see what happens at the end. If they forgive the son, if Alban gets to stay, if the family ends up accepting them. It's a good ending, though. It's a good ending.
That's Matthew McCoy, the director of Bay Area Musicals, finishing its first year, joined by Clay David. Clay, is this first time in your role as George?
This is the first time I played George, yes.
Tell me what you're bringing to the role.
Well, I think what I bring to the role is the idea of being a gay father and having a beautiful relationship with my partner, Alban. I feel that Alban and I, if Jean-Michel is 24 years old, that means that Alban and I have been together 20 years. And we started as a small cabaret circuit, and in 20 years we now have a very well-established, the jewel of the Riviera, La Cage aux Folles. And as partners, we raised our son backstage with all the dancers and the boas and the glitter. And I think that we represent same-sex parents who absolutely adore our son and will do anything to make him happy. And I think what we bring is that element of just being gay parents raising a heterosexual son in 1977.
Wow, yeah.
Which is a bit different than being a gay parent today. Mm-hmm. Matthew is bringing not a darker hue, but in 1977, you cannot hold hands in public in Saint-Tropez. You cannot kiss in public. And so you're always on guard, but still having those little private moments where you'll wink or just look at each other or just touch shoulders while you're walking. And that's just a beautiful underground way of saying, I love you unconditionally, but no one knows. That's our secret code. You know, nobody knows that we're raising a son.
Clay David as George in La Cage aux Folles, Bay Area Musicals. Information at BAMSF.org. We'll have some tickets to give away before the hour's out, so stay tuned for the rest of this conversation. Matt, tell me a bit about the rest of your cast. Well, Fred, before we get into the rest of the cast, one of the controversial elements that happens then is that the son becomes involved with the girl, takes her home, but her father is a very conservative Republican senator.
Mm-hmm. So. Talk about that.
Yeah, sure.
Wow.
Talk
sure.
about the dark side.
The dark side. So this family that comes to visit is constantly looking at every move that Jean-Michel's family makes, looking at how they end up redoing the entire apartment with a giant crucifix, and it looks like basically a monastery inside of their apartment versus a pink love seat. Which was in Act One. So then to have a complete transformation just to impress this family and to just make sure that the family is accepting of them, they're all basically having to have this facade. So I talked a lot about facade and what it means to have this constant cover-up or have to kind of live yourself within a lie, within a secret, which is great because at the end of Act One, Alban basically has this, you know, giant song, I Am What I Am, where he says, I'm not going to change for anyone. This is how I feel. This is how I want to be. And no one can make me do that. So in all the chaos, the mother of the son's supposed to be in attendance as well and ends up not coming. She sends a telegram. So then Jean-Michel freaks out because he wants everything to go perfect and it's not looking that way. So who comes to the rescue? Alban. As mother. He dresses up as mother. Right, right. It ends up convincing the Dindons, the Republican conservative family, that maybe this family is going to be normal. Here's this woman who's so nurturing and so loving and so pleasant to be around, where they eventually start to cross over and say, okay, maybe our daughter can marry this guy, until an accident happens, I guess I should say, and the restaurant where they go to have dinner at, where maybe Alban's facade is given away.
The movie, of course, memorably starring Nathan Lane as Alban and Robin Williams as George. We've heard a little bit from Clay about his part of George. Tell us a little bit about the rest of your cast.
So we have Michael R.J. Campbell, who's playing Alban, and Zaza, the dual character, and Mother. It's kind of like a trio of characters that he plays. He's from Sacramento. I've done two shows with him previously. We did The Addams Family together up at Sixth Street Playhouse in Santa Rosa. And then last summer, we did Fiddler on the Roof together at Berkeley Playhouse. So it's great to be working with people again. Some of the people that are going to steal the show are the Cajels. We have six Cajels that are all amazing dancers. Some of them have also already done drag before. One of them has done the show. Two of them actually have actually done the show before as well. Those are, I'm looking at my notes, Patrick Brewer, Michael Sayens, Christopher Juan, Malakani Severson, Lavelle Davis, and RJ San Jose. And they are kicking their face, you know, for every single performance.
And of course, the great music of Jerry Herman.
Jerry Herman, yeah.
Considered really his best musical when it comes down to it, which I didn't realize was that the book was by Harvey Fierstein.
Yeah. This is, I think, you know, Trilogy Torch Song was really what's made Harvey like a name, and I think this made him more of a household name, at least in the Broadway community, I should say. I mean, this really put him on the map, where he won a Tony for Best Book. And after Hello, Dolly, I think this is probably the most notable score that Jerry Herman has. All the songs are catchy and witty, and the lyrics are stunningly beautiful, even as simple as la-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The way he sets it, two of the melodic lines are... you just leave out humming, and I don't see that a lot with modern day musicals, where you really leave humming the tunes and remembering the lyrics.
No kidding. We're going to hear a memorable tune from the show in a moment, but can you give us a little foreshadow of season two of Bay Area Musicals?
Sure. We had a fundraiser event starring Eden Espinosa, who played Elphaba in Wicked on Broadway. She was a headliner for us back in May, and that's we also announced our second inaugural season. We'll be opening in the fall with the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, one of my personal favorites, because I think right now we need a little bit of laughter in our lives.
Sure.
Then we'll be doing in the spring Assassins. It'll be our first Stephen Sondheim musical, which very rarely gets done in the Bay Area as well. and we picked that for a lot of reasons, with a lot of gun violence that's going on right now, what it means to have a gun, and go and have an idea for an attack. And then we're closing out our season with our first family-friendly show, which will be Seussical the Musical. Mm-hmm. That'll be directed by Rachel Robinson. Darren Carollo will be directing Assassins, and I'll be directing Spelling Bee. And Seussical will be a full adult cast, so we think of it as a family-friendly show, not like a kid's show. We're still doing it with our own interpretation of it. Built-in cast that's going to actually play multiple roles for Seussical, all taking place in JoJo's apartment, so the apartment can come to life and switch around and move as JoJo's imagination creates the story of Dr. Seuss.
Nice. Well, we'll have to have you back in the fall to talk about these shows. Clay David, what's coming up for you down the road after La Cage? Always a dangerous question to ask an actor.
Oh, no. right after La Cage closes, I will be producing and being artistic director at Altarena Playhouse for The Book of Liz. And after that opens, I will start rehearsing. I'm directing Thornton Wilder's Our Town. And we are setting that also with the vintage period music of the early 1900s. And then I will be producing the Taffetas for the holidays, and that will be at Altarena.
Not much left to fill in your dance card. Good for you, Clay. That's Clay David. He's George in La Cage aux Folles. Bay Area Musicals opens Saturday night and runs through the 31st. Yep. Information at bamsf.org. Thanks for coming in, Clay.
Thank you so much.
Matt, we look forward to hearing you again.
Thank you.
And tickets for La Cage aux Folles, if you'd like a complimentary pair, we have four pair that we're offering at 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134. Information at bamsf.org for La Cage aux Folles at the Bay Area Musicals production, which closes out their inaugural season. And from the classic production, here is George Hearn singing I Am What I Am.
Special creation. So come take a look, give me the hook or the ovation. It's my world that I want to have a little pride in. My world, and it's not a place I have to hide in. Life's not worth a damn till you can say, hey world, I am what I am. I am what I am. I don't want praise. I don't want pity. Different angle. Your life is a sham till you can shout out loud, I am what I am. I am what I am, and what I am needs no excuses. I deal my own deck. Sometimes
that's Open Air for this Thursday, July 7th, 2016. A reminder that all of our shows are archived at our website. kalw.org. If you've got a show suggestion, send me an email, david@kalw.org. My thanks to both Lizak Shalit, who helped out in Niels Swinkel's absence, for helping produce Open Air. An hour of news from the BBC is next. It was recorded an hour earlier for broadcast at this time. It's 2 o'clock.
Welcome to News Ads, coming to you live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Tim Franks. Protests in the US over another two black men shot dead by police.
Please don't tell me that he's gone. Please, officer, don't tell me that you just did this to him. You shot four bullets into him, sir. He was just getting his license and registration, sir.
We'll hear from a man who's trained American police officers in the use of firearms. Also, the next British Prime Minister will be a woman.
We need proven leadership to negotiate the best deal for leaving the European Union, to unite our party and our country.
That's Theresa May. We'll hear about her and her challenger for the Conservative Party leadership, Andrea Leadsom. A new surgical technique for dealing with epilepsy, and the Vatican sentences a priest to jail over a leak. All that to come after the news.